From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Puerto Rico was a sovereign nation on the date of the drafting of the Treaty of Paris. And Spain could no more cede Puerto Rico than the United States could annex Puerto Rico, or than the entire world could negate Puerto Rican sovereignty.
In this centennial year of the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico, today a special on Don Pedro Albizu Campos, the leading Puerto Rican revolutionary of the 20th century.
Because the recognition of a nation's sovereignty is irrevocable. And when the United States, with its artillery, obligated the Spanish plenipotentiaries to sign the so-called cession of Puerto Rico, it was simply committing a holdup.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A United States District Court jury today ruled that three anti-abortion leaders had violated a federal racketeering law by conducting a nationwide campaign to intimidate abortion providers and patients. The jury of two men and four women, who deliberated since Thursday, found that 21 acts of intimidation, including physical violence outside clinics, amounted to a vast enterprise of extortion under the racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations law. The RICO Act was passed in 1970 as a way to fight organized crime, and some legal scholars have argued it should not apply to political groups. Cardinal Francis George of Chicago called the decision unjust and said the archdiocese might join in the appeal. He said the decision in this case effectively equates freedom of speech with racketeering, adding, if the courts had been used to stop the organized sit-ins at lunch counters throughout the South in the 60s, there would have been no civil rights movement. This news from San Francisco. Nike's claims that it pays overseas workers generously and protects them from health hazards amount to false advertising. This according to a lawsuit filed in San Francisco's Superior Court. The suit says the code of conduct that Nike promoted in the media was misleading and intended, quote, to entice consumers who do not want to purchase products made in sweatshops. The code should be considered the equivalent of false advertising claims, subjecting Nike to potentially huge damages. Nike, based in Beaverton, Oregon, has about 22,000 employees, but most of its products are made by 450,000 workers in Asian factories. The suit said Nike had stated that it guarantees a living wage to all workers, that its workers in Southeast Asia make twice the local minimum wage, receive free meals and health care, and are protected from corporal punishment, and that it complies with government rules on wages, hours, and health and safety conditions. Those claims, the suit says, are refuted by studies from labor and human rights groups, news media organizations, and January 1997 audit by the firm of Ernst & Young. The suit also cites sexual abuse and child labor in Nike factories. Workers put down their tools and joined student protesters in Bogota, the capital of Colombia, as it bid an emotional farewell to a top human rights lawyer killed over the weekend by suspected right-wing gunmen. Eduardo Humana Mendoza, a combative attorney whose clients included trade unionists, jailed guerrillas, political prisoners, and families of the disappeared, was killed in his Bogota office Saturday by gunmen posing as journalists who pumped six bullets into his head. This news from Indonesia. Campus protests against Indonesia's dictator Suharto and his government widened today as workers and professionals joined students in demonstrations across the country. Some 5,000 people held a protest rally in the Gajah Mada University in the ancient capital of Yogyakarta, demanding Suharto step down from office. Hundreds of workers joined the students in protest. Dictator Suharto gave security forces the green light last week to use force against students if they don't stop demonstrations. The powerful military has said it will not allow the protests to spread outside the campuses. This news from Geneva. The United Nations Commission on Human Rights today rejected a U.S.-sponsored resolution criticizing Cuba for violations of fundamental freedoms. Jacob Celebi of South Africa, who chairs the 53-member body, announced that the U.S. text had been defeated by a vote of 19 countries against, with 16 in favor and 18 abstentions. Neo-Nazis committed more crimes last year than at any other time since Germany was unified in 1990. This according to a Berlin newspaper. Citing Federal Crime Bureau statistics, it said more than 11,000 such incidents were reported, the heaviest percentage in the states of eastern Germany, where unemployment rates are high. It said close to 800 of the crimes were violent assaults on foreigners, the homeless, and other, quote, victim groups. The Clinton administration has declined to lift a 9-year-old ban on federal financing of programs to offer clean needles to drug addicts, even as the government's top scientists certified that such programs do not encourage drug abuse and can save lives by reducing the spread of AIDS. The United States and Britain have begun a secretive operation to remove highly enriched uranium and spent nuclear fuel from the volatile Caucasus nation of Georgia, this according to Western officials. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners. Well, Pedro Albizu Campos, popularly known as Don Pedro, was the most prominent, some would say the most notorious, Puerto Rican of this century. The nationalist leader fought for the independence of Puerto Rico and was in and out of U.S. jails for 25 years. He was born in 1893 and died 33 years ago today on April 21st, 1965, the same year that another famous nationalist leader, Malcolm X, died.
And today we're going to bring you a special on Pedro Albizu Campos. Under his leadership, the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico became a major force in the fight for independence. 3 days after the nationalist insurrection of October 30th, 1950, Albizu Campos was arrested for seditious conspiracy. He was sentenced to 72 years in jail. While in prison, Albizu Campos repeatedly charged he was the subject of human radiation experiments. Photo takens of him in prison show that his body was covered with welts. Albizu Campos was a fiery orator. Police stenographers transcribed 12 of his public speeches given between 1948 and 1950 as proof of the charges of seditious conspiracy leveled against him. He was found guilty on all counts. This is an excerpt of a speech Don Pedro gave just a month before his arrest in 1950.
Señor presidente de la Junta Municipal de Lares, damas y caballeros, no es fácil pronunciar un discurso cuando tenemos la madre tendida.
Mr. President of the Lares Municipal Council, ladies and gentlemen, it's not easy to give a speech when we have our mother laying in bed and an assassin waiting to take her life. Such is the present situation of our country, our mother. Of Puerto Rico. The assassin is the power of the United States of North America. One cannot give a speech while the newborn of our country are dying of hunger, while the adolescents of our homeland are being poisoned with the worst virus of them all, the virus of slavery, when the adults of our homeland must leave their hometown of Lares in fear. And they don't even have exit to countries other than the enemy power that binds us. They must go to the United States to be the slaves of the economic powers, of the tyrants of our country. They're the slaves who go to Michigan out of need, to be scorned and outraged and kicked. When one cannot easily give a speech, when this tyrant has the power to tear the sons right out of the hearts of Puerto Rican mothers, to send to Korea or into hell, to kill, to be the murderers of innocent Koreans, or to die covering a front for the Yankee enemies of our country, for them to return insane to their own people, or for them to return mutilated beyond recognition, even by their own mothers, it's not easy. Our blood boils, and patience beats at our hearts and tells us that patience must end, it must disappear, and that the day of Lares must be the day of Lares, which is to say, it must be the day of the Puerto Rican Revolution.
Este año es el centenario de la creación de la bandera de Cuba, que en el discurso...
This year is the 100th anniversary of the creation of the Cuban flag. And in the beautiful, deeply profound speech our illustrious Secretary General made in homage to the flag of Cuba, he compared it and called it the womb of our own flag. For this centennial of the Cuban flag is also the centennial of the Puerto Rican flag in the sense of origin. We have called together here those who want the union of our brothers, of our Latin American brothers, and very specially the Cubans, all the people of the Antilles, the Haitians, the Dominicans. For all of them, love the independence of Puerto Rico as their very own. Because as long as Puerto Rico is not free, every single one of those nations feels mutilated. The Cuban standard was raised by Narciso López, and a Puerto Rican took part in the invasion by Narciso López, General Valero de Bernabe of Fajardo, who maintained close relations with Iznaga, one of Narciso López's expeditionaries. As I understand it, at that time, Valero was the chief of general staff in the Venezuelan army, which means our blood has always been on a level with the supreme height of human dignity. We reiterate our salute to all the heroes and martyrs of the great Cuban nation. On this day, we especially greet the young people studying in the University of Havana.
Pedro Albizu Campos, popularly known as Don Pedro, today on Democracy Now!, a special on his life. This is a speech he gave in 1950. Juan, where was this speech given?
This was in the town of Lares on September 23rd, 1950, the anniversary of the first independence revolution of Puerto Rico against Spanish colonialism. And what we'd like to do now is, first of all, most of our listeners know very little about Pedro Albizu Campos. Unfortunately, most people in the United States know little about this country's largest and most productive colony over all these years. He came to his father had been a customs inspector. He had been appointed a customs inspector when the Americans invaded Puerto Rico in 1898 during the Spanish-American War. His father was one of those who greeted the Americans, was appointed customs inspector of the town of Ponce, where Don Pedro was born and grew up. And he eventually got a Masonic scholarship to go to the United States in 1913 to attend the University of Vermont. But while at the University of Vermont, a couple of Harvard professors who were teaching for some summer courses noted how intelligent he was and convinced him to transfer to Harvard, where he proceeded to get his bachelor's degree and attend Harvard Law School and graduate as a lawyer from Harvard. And it was during that time, this was in 1916, 1917, that he became exposed to the Irish nationalist movement, which in Boston and Harvard at that time, of course, this was the time of the Easter Rebellion in 1916 in Ireland, he began to be further awakened to nationalist ideas. And one of our guests with us today is Agustin Lau, who has taught at the City University of New York and who is completing a doctoral dissertation now on imperialism as it relates specifically to Ireland and Puerto Rico. So I'd like to welcome Agustin Lau.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about this period of Albizu Campos' life.
Well, as you already said, when Albizu came to the United States, he came with a Masonic scholarship, so he wasn't Catholic. So there are two significant aspects about Albizu's life and ideology that is going to be highly influential in his politics that have to do with his experience in Harvard And both of them actually are observed in Juan Antonio Corretjer's biography of Albizu. You know that Corretjer was one of the revolutionaries who went to jail with Albizu in 1936 and became one of the most important poets and ideologues and political activists of Puerto Rican nationalism. And Corretjer observed that Albizu, on the one hand, converted to Catholicism while he was in Harvard under the influence of an Irish priest with the last name Ryan. And on the other hand, Albizu became an activist in the Irish nationalist movement in the same time. And this is a really critical moment in the history of Irish nationalism, is the Eastern Uprising, which unleashed in the independence of Ireland in 1921, and the radicalism of the Irish nationalist movement, I think, is really important to understand the chief that Albizu takes himself, and after that he takes to Puerto Rican nationalism that was very much cultural nationalism, a salon kind of nationalism of intellectuals who were not taking it, translating it into a radical movement against imperialism, up to armed struggle, and definitely the exposure to the Eastern Uprising and to all of that situation of Irish nationalism has a lot to do with the changes that Albizu took in his life.
Well, one of the leaders of the Irish movement, of course, was Imán de Valera, right? Was there any relationship between him and Don Pedro?
Well, you know, Imán de Valera was the first president of the Irish Republic, and his father was Spanish, and there is speculation, I'm still researching that also Puerto Rican, and they did have a relationship, and some of the co-students of Albizu in Harvard Law School drafted the Irish Constitution together with de Valera, and there is thought, and I still had to do more research in that, because the problem is that nobody really have engaged that research rigorously, and that's part of what I'm doing in my dissertation. But there are indications that Albizu was one of the people who actually drafted the Irish Constitution. But, you know, another figure that I think is really important to consider here in the rethinking of Albizu and Puerto Rican nationalism is James O'Connelly, because Connelly who was the main leader of the Eastern Uprising, who was killed as part of it. He was a Marxist, and he was Catholic at the same time. And, you know, it's interesting to see the connection here between Catholicism and radicalism, because in the interpretation that we have of Albizu, for example, in Ferrao, they say that he was Catholic and he was conservative, but you can see a strand of radicalism in Catholicism that goes through Connolly that may give a different light to the way that we see Albizu.
Of course, many people don't realize that throughout this period in the 19th century, many Irish priests were trained in Spain, and there has always been a connection, because Ireland, being surrounded clearly by or invaded by England, a Protestant nation, the survival of the Catholic religion assumed a social and political importance for Ireland, just as the survival of the Catholic religion, once Puerto Rico was invaded by the United States, assumed an importance in terms of the national definition of the people, didn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I do have a different reading of that, but that's not the theme. Mm-hmm. I mean, Albizu obviously defined the Puerto Rican nation on the basis of Catholicism. I mean, and we can see it clearly in the whole rhetoric of Lares. I think that is neatly seen that way. I mean, the road to Lares in the celebration of El Grito de Lares that we just heard the speech, it's like a pilgrimage, no? And Lares is defined as the sacred land, because that's where the sacrifice that founded the nation through the blood of the martyrs of the Cry of Lares in September of 1868 marked Lares at the birth of the Puerto Rican nation. And Albizu himself, as an apostle of the Puerto Rican Revolution, which is the way in which he is described by Puerto Rican nationalism, is a kind of Christologic figure because his body, as we said, it was submitted to imperialist domination. He was in jail. He was tortured. So the nation is seen as a Catholic nation. But I will say that the Puerto Rican nation, unlike the Irish nation, is not simply a Catholic nation. It's a much more diverse nation, as well as U.S. imperialism is not as Protestant as British imperialism.
Agustin Lau, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk about Pedro Albizu Campos. He died 33 years ago today on April 21st, 1965. And in this centennial year of the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico in 1898, we'll be bringing you a series of programs on Puerto Rico, culminating on July 25th, the day of the invasion. Agustin Lau teaches at the City University of New York, teaches ethnic studies, writing a dissertation comparing the struggles of the Puerto Ricans and the Irish. When we come back, we'll be joined by others. We'll hear more from Don Pedro, his own rare speeches that we're able to bring you today. And we'll talk with a younger generation about what his legacy means. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. On this day, we bring you a special on Pedro Albizu Campos, known as the leading Puerto Rican nationalist of the 20th century.
Yes, Amy, and we're going to move on now to from the period he was in Harvard. He returns to Puerto Rico after a trip through Latin America. He also, by the way, volunteered to serve in World War I and was a commissioned second lieutenant in the American Army during World War I. But then, after a trip to Latin America, returns to Puerto Rico and in 1930 is elected president of the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico. And we have here to talk about that period Pedro Rivera, who's been a longtime researcher at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College of the City University and a lecturer at a borough of Manhattan Community College. And also we have Mario Cesar Romero, an art historian who attended the University of Puerto Rico in the 1950s and actually attended the funeral of Albizu Campos, which was a major event on the island in 1965. So, Pedro, could you tell us a little bit about his life once he returned to Puerto Rico and became a political figure on the island?
I actually like to, because it's such a complex period, and I'm not a specialist on Albizu, just highlighting an aspect of the period that I think is of relevance for us in today's discussion. And that has to do with the role that Albizu plays during the 1930s, particularly in the 1934 sugarcane strike in Puerto Rico. And I mentioned the strike not just because this wasn't just one more sugarcane strike. There were many throughout the first 30 years of U.S. rule in Puerto Rico, and particularly because of the rise of the sugar monopolies and the control of that industry over the island's entire economy. But the 1934 strike was really became more than just a labor management conflict. It was really became a mass strike, in fact, and it was a strike in which the rank and file of the largest labor union in Puerto Rico at that time, led by the FLT, the Federation of Free Laborers, was pretty much uprise against their own trade union leadership, who they understood to have sold out in the context of this strike, and not only in the context of the strike, but in the context of the past few years in the decades of the 1930s. So that in effect, what was happening was that there was a political vacuum in terms of the working class. And we must understand that the Puerto Rican working class during the first 30 years in Puerto Rico had been organized on a very radical basis. It was a radical socialist movement. And even though it was not an anti-imperialist political movement in the sense of being a pro-independence movement as a whole, it did have pro-independence elements within its ranks. And more than anything, where it was mostly concerned with fighting the local class enemies in Puerto Rico, those who were associated with the sugar monopolies, and of course the owners of the sugar monopolies themselves, and not so much fighting the U.S. government, which was kind of a contradiction we don't have much time to get into now, but that was the nature of the situation. And in that context, Albizu, because on his return from Latin America, had become very radicalized in terms of his understanding of imperialism. And the alliances that he had been able to develop there had the moral and political authority to address issues that other leaders in Puerto Rico at that time, including socialist leaders themselves, did not have. So ironically, Albizu, who was well-known as a nationalist and not necessarily a pro-worker person in a political way, although not necessarily anti-worker either, was called to lead the strike in 1934. So it's kind of significant that here you have Albizu Campos, a major political leader of the nationalist movement, being called by socialist workers to lead a strike, which kind of attests to the stature of the political stature that Albizu had achieved at that time. And I would attribute it, and many other people attribute that that kind of political authority that Albizu acquired to his boldness in terms of the way he addressed the issue of imperialism in Puerto Rico, the way he described it in his speeches, the way he described it in his tours throughout Latin America, his diplomatic work, which was really very powerful at the time, was the only real nationalist and national leader in Puerto Rico that was taking that kind of role. Some people argue that actually some of the more conservative nationalists got rid of Albizu and sent him to Latin America because he was becoming too radical. And that's one thing that has been argued, you know, by some scholars. And the fact is that Albizu was, at that time, the most radical nationalist leader, you know, in that particular set of years.
Well, interestingly enough, too, that period between 1934 and 36 or so, 37, was perhaps the period of greatest upheaval in Puerto Rico.
That's
because the United States had been on the island now for about 35, 40 years. The sugar companies had taken over the whole island. The United States had ordered English to be taught in all the public schools as a language of instruction. All the major departments of the government were run by Americans. And there was, in essence, there was this incredible sense of that the promise of the United States when it had come to Puerto Rico had not been fulfilled. And so you had this period of intense upheaval, not only among the sugar workers, but obviously among the nationalists themselves. And I know that, Mario, you've done incredible research in terms of art and photography and the influence of Don Pedro on the artistic generation of Puerto Ricans and Latin Americans. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because that's something that's rarely discussed.
Good morning, Juan. First of all, I don't know if you can say that I've done an incredible. I'm working on some research right now. I hope to write a monograph on the subject of art and portraiture, and very specifically, I want to use Don Pedro as the 20th century example. Interestingly enough, one of the things that I have discovered is that in view of the many photographs that were taken by the press, these have served as a source of inspiration for many of the painters in Puerto Rico, not only painters, but sculptors, folk artisans. And also, there are artists, I have just heard that there are artists even in Ireland that have used photographs of Don Pedro to paint an homage to Don Pedro. What is interesting is that whereas portraiture was the means by which political leaders perpetuated themselves, their authority over peoples in the past, historically since pre-Roman times up to the present date. Let's look, for example, at Napoleon and the official painters of the court of Napoleon, that in the 20th century there isn't really any figure that used the portrait to that extent. As a matter of fact, in the 20th century, most politicians are actors for the TV cameras, and there is a very different language that is emitted through being an actor for a TV camera versus being a sitter either in vivo or through a photograph. And there isn't any artist in Puerto Rico today, even those that are estadistas, those that advocate stateshood for my country, that hasn't painted at some point of his career an homage to Don Pedro. The impact of Don Pedro is so overwhelming that there has to be a respect that comes from everyone, regardless of what his political position is. In the research that I'm working on, I discovered, and I don't recall the person's name, I just found out from a very prominent Puerto Rican artist, the Johannes Ballester, that there is an old man in Ponce, Puerto Rico, who happens to be a mask maker. Ponce is a very, we call it La Ciudad Señorial, and it's a city with long-standing traditions, one of them being the carnival that dates back to the 18th century. And the type of mask that is worn by the Vejigante figures is made of paper mache and cardboard. Well, it seems that some not a college-educated artist has made a 12-foot sculpture of Don Pedro Albizu Campos, who, by the way, was also born in Ponce. And he has made this in paper mache. So that the folk traditions, here is this artisan whose medium is the traditional paper mache, has made a 12-foot sculpture in honor and that of Don Pedro, and that has been preserved and saved. Want to be
well,
able
but
to...
Why is that? Why do so many artists feel a need to, in some way or other, reflect on his meaning for the Puerto Rican nation?
That's a very good question, Juan. I believe that what Don Pedro symbolizes has to, it affects all of us, and it has to do with what it means to be a Puerto Riqueño and not to give in to a cultural invasion as well as the political invasion. Don Pedro stood for the deepest values of our heritage and our culture. You've been discussing the Catholicism, the Masonic links that he had, etc. He understood that the kind of domination that the United States control had in Puerto Rico was definitely going to infiltrate our culture. As you have mentioned, English was imposed upon us, just as American citizenship was imposed upon us so that we could be justifiably drafted into World War I. And he understood that our culture was going to dissipate, and in the process, our sense of identity was going to be destroyed. So for the artists, whether especially those that are independentistas, but even those that are not independentistas, whether they believed in Don Pedro's ultimate message of our need to be an independent nation, it was important to take this symbol and to popularize it. Don Pedro has not died in the minds of even the young Puerto Ricans who did not know him.
We're talking to Mario Cesar Romero, who is an art historian, attended the University of Puerto Rico in the 1950s. 1960s, excuse me, and Pedro Rivera, who teaches at the Borough of Manhattan Community College. As we talk about Don Pedro Albizu Campos, this on the 33rd anniversary of his death, April 21st, 1965, moving back and forth from the cultural to the political, what about, Juan, when Don Pedro was first arrested in Puerto Rico?
Right, well, actually, his first arrest came in 1936. There had been a series of attacks. First, in 1935, four Puerto Rican students were killed at the University of Puerto Rico. That touched off a series of counterattacks. The chief of police, Colonel Riggs, an American in Puerto Rico, was then assassinated by some nationalists who in turn were killed by the police. And so there was a cycle of violence that escalated to the point where Don Pedro and several other members of the Nationalist Party, including Juan Antonio Corregel, Clemente Soto Velez, and others, were all arrested by the U.S. attorney in Puerto Rico for seditious conspiracy. Within 2 weeks of their arrest, they were put on trial on a federal court in Puerto Rico before a jury of seven Puerto Ricans and five Americans, and the jury was hung. All seven Puerto Ricans voted to acquit him. All five Americans voted to convict him. Then the U.S. attorney, not satisfied, had a new trial within a week. And in the second trial, he had 10 Americans on the jury and two Puerto Ricans, and the vote was 10-2 to convict. And this time he was convicted, and he was sentenced. He and the other nationalists were sentenced to 10 years in Atlanta Penitentiary. And he was released after about 7 or 8 years and returned to Puerto Rico in 1948, where once again mass protests erupted and a new era of revolt until culminating in the revolution of Jayuya in 1950, which was just a month after the speech that we are giving you excerpts from today.
And we wanted to play a bit more of that speech. Again, this Don Pedro Albizu Campos, just a month before he was arrested again and charged with seditious conspiracy in 1950. This speech he gave is translated by Walter Crockmile.
Venimos ante una realidad de nuestra patria en que el enemigo.
Today we face a state in our country in which the enemy, that is to say, the United States of North America, feels defeated by the right we earned in the American Commission of Dependent Territories. It feels defeated by the Commission's recognition that Puerto Rico is a nation under intervention by the power of the United States. The U.S. did not dare attend an inter-American conference for the first time in the history of America. Why? The U.S. had the right to a seat there and always has a right to a seat there on the American Commission of Dependent Territories. Why didn't it attend? Because in its midst, by intrinsic right, Puerto Rican entities would also be attending. That's the work of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party, which in Bogotá secured direct participation for all those entities interested in the state of U.S. military intervention in Puerto Rico. So the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico turned up with its Puerto Rican independence flag, not to clamor for the possibility of recognition granted by positive law, by natural law, which we can demand any time, but to demand recognition because within the framework of positive international law, Puerto Rico was a sovereign nation on the date of the drafting of the Treaty of Paris. And Spain could no more cede Puerto Rico than the United States could annex Puerto Rico, or than the entire world could negate Puerto Rican sovereignty, because the recognition of a nation's sovereignty is irrevocable. And when the United States, with its artillery, obligated the Spanish plenipotentiaries to sign the so-called cession with Puerto Rico, it was simply committing a holdup of the sort that is typical of North Americans. And that coercion of Spanish will bore no legitimacy in Puerto Rico, because Puerto Rico is a sovereign nation. It had nothing to do with the Spanish-American War. It was never a belligerent party on behalf of the U.S. or anyone. And the Yankees have been here for over 52 years, waging war on the Puerto Rican nation. And they've never once acquired a right in Puerto Rico. There is no legal government in Puerto Rico, and that's incontestable. You'd have to knock to pieces the entire framework of world law, of international law, to validate the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico and the present military occupation of our national territory. And the Yankees can't sit down at the table with jurists to demand of the jurists that they tell them that the present U.S. military intervention in Puerto Rico has any legitimacy at all. And that's why they didn't dare attend the Havana Conference. They sabotaged it so it wouldn't convene. They overthrew governments to keep them from attending. They intimidated the whole hemisphere, and it all failed. The commission met and resolved that Puerto Rico is a nation under intervention. Votes were cast so that Puerto Rico would have the opportunity to enter the society of the free peoples of the world. They know that they have...
Don Pedro Albizu Campos, popularly known as Don Pedro, the most prominent Puerto Rican nationalist of this century, as we bring you a special today on this 33rd anniversary of his death, April 21st, 1965, after being released from a prison in that last stay in prison for about 15 years. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and if you'd like a copy of today's show and this historic speech, a rare speech recording that we have of Don Pedro, you can give us a call at the Pacifica Archives, and we'll send it out to you at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we'll give that speech and phone number out at the end of the show as well. When we come back, we'll find out about Don Pedro's funeral in 1965, about his charges of being the subject of human radiation experiments in prison, and about what young people today take from Don Pedro's legacy. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez on the special we bring you in the centennial year of the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico. Today, a special on Pedro Albizu Campos, the most famous revolutionary in Puerto Rico of this century. Juan?
Of course, when Don Pedro was alive, the United States government claimed he was a madman, he was a terrorist, he was someone who had no following. But I'd like to ask Mario Cesar Romero, who attended his funeral, what that was like and what the response of Puerto Ricans was to his death.
Juan, I would first of all like to backtrack a little in order to answer your question and put it into context. My father was a person who believed in the ideals of Don Pedro. I grew up in this tradition. I recall very clearly in 1950 when Don Pedro was arrested because of the Blair House incident, how Dad just, you know, everything had to stop. There had to be extreme silence.
And when the Blair House incident was?
That was in 1950. And
the attempted assassination of President Truman,
exactly,
by two nationalists to spread the word of the revolution in Puerto Rico that was occurring at the same time.
Yeah. And in any case, so when I studied at the University of Puerto Rico, I was active with all of the more progressive thinking groups of FUPI, MPI, the Federación Universitaria Pro Independencia, and the Movimiento Pro Independencia. I recall that afternoon when I stepped out of class, I was going over to the Centro Estudiantil, the University Student Center, when suddenly there was the news that Don Pedro had died. I had already had the honor of being able to go to visit him in San Sebastian Street with a number of other people. I was overwhelmed. I mean, I was just like really overwhelmed. Within, I think less than 15 minutes, already numbers of students were beginning to meet in front of, on the Avenida Ponce de León, in front of the university, walk to the tower. And carteles, letreros, posters, were being hand-painted, and pictures of Don Pedro, those popular pictures, were being held by students. And I was so devastated by this that instead of joining my compañeros, I went home and tried to gather my thoughts. I recall going to the Jensen Funeral Parlor that evening, and there was such a mayhem of people. I had never experienced anything like this in Puerto Rico. And especially for Don Pedro, who was a controversial person. But there again, I want to underline the fact that he, in a certain sense, even touched the hearts and the souls of those people who did not necessarily openly adhere to his political ideology. And when he was being interred, is that how you say
yes,
in English?
Buried.
Interred in the ground, I was just like no more than 10 feet from where Don Juan Mari and Laura Meneses were, and I want to make reference to something that was said earlier. They had a little exchange of words because Don Juan Mari Brás,
who at that time was one of the main independence leaders.
That's right. That's right, Juan.
And Laura Meneses was Don Pedro's
widow at that point. And she had been given special permission to come from Cuba. She was living in exile in Cuba so that she could attend the funeral. Juan Mari wanted a priest that was there to be able to say some words over the cadaver while it was being interred. And Laura, being the hardcore Marxist, did not want that. And I'd like to offer you this as a token of thanks. It's a poster by Mauricio Preto.
Oh,
and
thank
also
you.
The record of Revolutionary Songs.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank Maria Lopez.
Okay. Well, what we have with us now, two young women who are involved very much in the campaign to organize a major protest at the United Nations on July 25th in relationship to the continued colonial status of Puerto Rico. And that is Erica Gonzalez and Raquel Rivera, both of them members of the Puerto Rican Collective. And I'd like to ask them what you, when you were growing up and attending school, what Don Pedro and the struggle of the nationalists has meant to you in terms of your formation?
I think that
Raquel
for me,
Rivera.
Erica. For me, learning about Albizu Campos was very inspiring. It was amazing to see, to learn about a Puerto Rican actively resisting. And that was inspiring and that was new for me. And it was also something that made me angry because I realized that it was history that had been kept from me. The words of Albizu, one of his famous phrases is, "When tyranny is law, revolution is order." And for me, that was very profound, not because it was something new, because we had learned about philosophers like John Locke, who had who believed in when a government abused the rights of people, the people had the right to rebel. But to hear a Puerto Rican say it and actively demonstrate it was something very new.
Yeah, okay. For me, it was pretty much the same. And like Erica, I was very angry that all throughout, I grew up in Puerto Rico and I went to school over there. And Don Pedro was mentioned just briefly and nothing really in depth. It was through other people that were active in the independence movement that I was able to start learning about Don Pedro and about the nationalist movement and all this history. And to me, one of the most impressive things was the fact that he struggled so hard. And it was a lifelong commitment, and that's one of the things that stuck most clearly in my mind, just that sense of commitment that you go to all lengths just to go through with what you think.
And could you tell us about the protest that you're planning and why you're helping to organize this protest?
Well, I think that three approaches that the Nationalist Party took were to break the isolation of Puerto Rico from Latin America and the rest of the world, to establish common fronts, and to show the contradictions between a country that preaches democracy but fails to practice it at home. So that those are the kind of approaches that we're employing in the mobilization. This is a massive march that's going to happen on July 25th to the United Nations to protest 100 years of colonialism in Puerto Rico. So we're mobilizing. This is not a Puerto Rican march. This is a march of a coalition march where we have people from the Malcolm X grassroots movement involved, Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence, etc. So this is a broad coalition that is going to make a statement that in 1998 we still have people, a significant number of people who are resisting colonialism.
And at the same time that this march takes place in New York at the United Nations, there will also be a major march in Puerto Rico on that day.
Right,
July
at Guanica.
25th.
Right.
And if people want to find out about the march or participate in helping to organize it, where can they contact?
They should call 1-888-509-2103.
Could you repeat that?
888-509-2103.
That's 1-888-509-2103.
You know, we wanted to play more of Don Pedro's speech that he gave just before he was arrested in 1950 for seditious conspiracy. And Juan, maybe you can give a little context here. This is before actually what happened to him in prison happened in the following 15 years that he served in and out of prison until really just a few months before his death. But a major issue that has been raised has been that he charged throughout that time that he was in prison that he was a victim of human radiation experiments.
Yes, he did. And there were many other Puerto Ricans who knew him, who they had special doctors come from Cuba. These are in the Batista era, come from Cuba to examine him and to verify that he had unbelievable burn like marks all over his legs, and he also, Don Pedro, spent many years exposing what he believed were all kinds of experimentation that was going on among the Puerto Rican people by American doctors, even issues of special examination injections of cancer and other issues that were never really resolved, but he firmly believed that the United States government was conducting experimentation on Puerto Ricans.
And this is the fall of 1950, Don Pedro Albizu Campos speaking in Puerto Rico.
No one dares talk about it, but there's more. An eminent Yankee physician, Dr. Filgert, has said that Puerto Rico is sitting on a powder keg. It's not Albizu Campos saying that, it's Dr. Filgert, brought here for the insular government. I'm going to tell you a secret that's not so secret. The United States has converted Puerto Rico into an atomic base. And the United States has in Puerto Rico, under the direct administration of the U.S. Army, a vast research facility for germ warfare, for bacteriological warfare. One of those laboratories is behind the Capitol, looking out to sea. That laboratory is experimenting with every single contagious disease on Earth. They're experimenting in that laboratory with a disease that's endemic to high plateaus of the Rocky Mountains. It's a terrible fever. Why don't they experiment with it in the area to which it's endemic? Why bring those viruses, those germs, from that disease to Puerto Rico to experiment with it? Well, it might spread over there. And if it spreads here, then it's just Puerto Ricans. What's the difference? They killed a few in Korea. After the next atomic war, there might not be any left. What's the difference? That laboratory is on the main artery coming into San Juan. That's where they have the cages with animals in them. Let's say infected animals. There are infected animals there. Horses, cows, chickens, rabbits, rats. Any bit of froth from one of those animals might fall in the dust, and the dust flies off, and any person traveling on an open bus could absorb it and transmit it to the rest of the population. Has the legislature said anything about that? No. They're willing to burn up their whole country as long as they can enjoy their privileges. You might say, no, it's great scientific research.
My friends, it's under the direct command of the U.S. Army. No army is a charitable institution. Armies are made for killing. And this is under the command of the U.S. Army. The U.S. Army Medical Corps, which they call the Yankee Hospital Services, hasn't dared take charge of the research because they don't want to be disaccredited as physicians. The School of Tropical Medicine hasn't dared to take charge of the research in Puerto Rico. So I invite the defenders of the Yankee flag in Puerto Rico to study that ongoing infection that's flying over their motherland. There's more still. That constitution is already written. Everything is written because the master never trusts the slaves. No, the slave is always alone, apart. He knows that when the sun comes out, he disappears into the sun. When there are shadows, he disappears into the shadows. The master never trusts the slave. The master trusts his free enemy. Because if that enemy is a free man, he says to his face, "Listen here, you come this far, you agree with me to go that far, and we both respect that border." And he signs a treaty with a free man and respects him, because that man is free. But a slave signs his name, and his name is worth nothing. That constitution they're going to make the Puerto Ricans draft in 52 is already written. Why? Because when Puerto Ricans, or better said, the voters here, draft a constitution, it doesn't become the law. No, because if they're slaves, then the constitution isn't that of a free country. Constituents draft a constitution and approve it, promulgate it. It becomes the law of the land. No, none of that. This is going to have to be approved by the President of the United States first. The President has to say it's fine. He has to determine. The President has to approve it. And if he approves it, then comes Congress. Why? All this anxiety over an illusion, something that will sign Puerto Rico over to despotism? Well, that must be defied. And it must only be defied the way the men of Lares defied despotism, with a revolution.
Pedro Albizu Campos, known as Don Pedro, speaking just before his arrest in 1950 in Puerto Rico, read by Walter Crockmall. Juan?
Yes, and he died on April 21st, 1965. A few days after his death, Cesar Andreu Iglesias, one of the most prominent journalists in Puerto Rico, wrote these words in El Imparcial: "It would be an illusion to believe that Albizu's life has ended. It is just now beginning. In deep crises, a single conscience can save a people. Puerto Ricans were lucky to have Albizu. What would have become of us without him? He knew no compromise or surrender. That is where the incomprehension begins. If only Albizu had spoken with less anger, if Albizu had only denounced with less fire, if Albizu had only accused with less passion. But that precisely is the difference between an apostle and a politician. The politician is with everyone, or pretends to be. The apostle is alone with his conscience. He is not with others. They are with him, to whatever extent and number that may be. No man inspired greater admiration from his people than Albizu. The person who represents the conscience of a people can hardly hope to triumph. His mission is not to save himself, but to save us. In that self-sacrifice is his victory, the final triumph of the cause to which Albizu devoted his entire life."
Well, Juan, I want to thank you very much for organizing today's show on Don Pedro Albizu Campos. If people want a copy of today's show, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230, including the full speech. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!